I guess for the last few years, the last 100 years or more, we've really been looking down when we've been thinking about where our energy is going to come from. And we've ignored the abundant solar energy around us that used to supply all our needs prior to the industrial development of the human society. And now we need to start looking back up. As we see the issues that are arising with fossil fuel use in particular. So today I want to talk about photovoltaic technology, what it is, why it's interesting, the sorts of technical developments that are underway and how people are using photovoltaics, what the markets are doing, what costs are doing. I hope, Jeanette, you'll be pleasantly surprised. And then a little bit of a look at the status in New Zealand and maybe some suggestions on where you might go from here. I'll just mention briefly the IEA PVPS, which I'm involved with. Oh, and I want to acknowledge, you'll see through my presentation lots of lovely photos. A lot of them are from New Zealand, and when the New Zealand PV industry heard that I was coming to give this lecture, they kindly inundated me with photos of PV systems around the country. So it'll give you an indication that there are lots of beautiful PV installations in New Zealand already. And I would like to thank all the PV industry who sent me photos. Firstly, just to distinguish, because this is a public lecture and I can't go into a huge amount of detail about lots of things and I'm covering a lot of information, but to make sure people in the audience are aware that photovoltaics is different to solar water heating, although they're both using the sun. You can see on that house there's a solar water heater in the back and a photovoltaic array in the front. And that's the sort of photovoltaic array that you might be familiar with seeing. Photovoltaics is an interesting technology. It's like magic. Sun falls on these flat sheets that are just sitting there doing nothing very much else, and you generate electricity. It's a disruptive technology. It changes the way you think about power supply. We tend to think about big generating plants and lines connecting them to the consumer, and suddenly you've got photovoltaics that can be very much at the consumer end of that whole spectrum of the electricity system. And you can have photovoltaics on your wristwatch, you can have it in your calculator, you can have it in your house, as Jeanette has, you can have it even in large power stations. So from sort of milliwatt levels to megawatt levels. Very versatile technology, and there are a range of different technologies as well, each suited to different applications. You can have it on grid, you can have off grid, you can have it built into your buildings, or sitting on top of buildings, or on top of power poles, or just standing alone in frames. No huge visual impact if you want to build it into structures. No noise, no emissions, no fumes, no moving parts. Very interesting technology and very different to most other generating technologies. The word photovoltaics has people stumbling, but really if you think about the derivation, photo, meaning light, and voltage, giving you the light-induced electricity. So if you think of it that way, it's not a difficult word. And we tend to be sticking to it despite, I guess, the media preferring just to talk solar energy. But when you're trying to distinguish between a range of different solar technologies, it's useful to think about, to talk about photovoltaics specifically. So the technology then that you're most familiar with is based on crystalline silicon. Silicon is a semiconductor, so it's the same silicon that's used in all your computers. When photons of light, the energy in light, hits the solar cell, the energy is sufficient to release an electron from the valence to the conduction band, and you can conduct electricity if you connect that to a circuit. Cell efficiencies are defined in terms of the amount of sunlight that's falling on your cell that's converted into useful electricity. So the definitions are usually in a square meter area, and they'll say, okay, we will assume that a square meter gets 1,000 watts of sunlight, and therefore your efficiency is based on how many watts you get out compared to that 1,000 watts that's coming in. Most of the cells that you've been familiar with are made from crystalline silicon. Silicon is refined from sand, an abundant material, non-toxic, but to process it into solar cells, we need to take the silicon from sand, get the oxygen out of the silicon dioxide. They make a melt of silicon and they pull a crystal like that out. You see crystalline, and you slowly pull this whole crystal, single crystal of silicon out of the melt. It takes a long time to grow a crystal like that. When you've got one, you slice it into thin wafers to make your solar cells. When you've got a solar cell, you put it into with other solar cells to make a module, depending on how much power you want. And you can connect those cells up to get whatever voltage or current that suits your purposes. And then you can put those modules together to form an array. And that's what you see on houses. You'll see an array, so several modules typically. For a standalone application, such as Jeanette's house, you'll put a battery bank in as well. The electricity produced from your solar cell is produced as direct current and can go straight into your battery bank or straight into DC loads. DC loads can be lights, bridges, a whole range of things can be DC, but we're used to having AC for most of our appliances nowadays, unless you have a caravan or something. And so typically you will want at least some of your power going through what's called an inverter to provide AC power for everyday appliances. But if you're connected to the grid, you don't need to have that battery bank, because in effect the grid is supplying that storage capacity. You just have your power going through in the DC going through your inverter and into your AC loads. You can then connect that inverter to the grid, and you can use power from the grid when there's no sun, and you can put excess electricity back into the grid if you've got surplus to your needs. Because it's a solar dependent technology, it really depends very much how you place your solar panels or solar modules. You want to be able to get the most out of your array, and so you want to face it as close to the sun and the sun angle as possible. Now, as you know, the sun moves across the sky each day, and it also moves up and down from winter to summer. So if you have a static array, you're going to have to try and make some compromise as to what the best position is going to be over the year. And you can make that compromise based on, for instance, the angle of your roof. And you might say, well, I know the angle of my roof isn't ideal, but it's easier to just follow that angle and have the array sit at that same angle. Or you can put it on a frame to get your optimum angle. Normally your optimum angle is your latitude angle and facing north. That's the red dot there, for instance. The more you move away from the latitude angle facing north, the less power you're going to get out of that module over the year. silicon solar cells, and most solar cells are also impacted by temperature. Solar cells reduce their output as temperatures go up, and sometimes rooftop temperatures can get very high. And cells are rated, as I mentioned before, at 25 degrees, so if your roof is at 70 degrees, you are going to have less power. So what you want to do is try and keep your modules as cool as you can. You want to have airflow or other means of keeping your modules cool. The output you get is dependent also on the type of cell that you use and its rated efficiency. We'll look at technologies now. This is a new type of module. This is a cadmium telluride, a thin film module. This is a test centre in Alice Springs. At the moment, most of the cells, as I said, are silicon cells. They're both monocrystalline, which I've described, pulling the single crystal out, or multicrystalline, which is a cheaper way of making a crystalline silicon cell, but not as efficient. You can see there the picture with the multicrystalline, you can see the crystal, different crystals in there. And because of all that, those crystal boundaries, you lose efficiency, but it is cheaper to do it this way. So instead of pulling the crystal out of the melt, you pour the melt into a vat and you cool it slowly. The slower you cool it, the bigger the crystals you can form, but of course you're compromising between, you know, the cost of doing that and the efficiency you want to get out. But once you've got your solid block of silicon, you treat it the same way as you would for the monocrystalline product. You slice it into wafers and process it into cells. Now you can see there that there's a green block of thin film cells. They're the sorts of cells that the cadmium telluride module in the past photo was showing you, and that is an increasing little slice of the pie. First generation technology is how we typically refer to the crystalline silicon cells that you're most familiar with, and mono was first, and now we've got multi. There is also a ribbon silicon where you're pulling from the melt and pulling it into a sheet and forming the cell that way rather than wafering it. Cells of that type, all those three types, tend to range from 12 to 20% efficiency. There's some product now starting to go on the market at higher, 22 to 25% efficiency. Thin films are the second generation. That's where instead of doing the wafering, you're coating your substrate with your solar cell that you form by layering different layers of material onto your substrate. And there's a range of cell types like that. Amorphous silicon is the one you'd be most familiar with. It's the ones in watches and calculators and so on that you've seen, slightly reddish tint compared to the silicon, crystalline silicon, which has the bluish tint. Slightly lower efficiency, but improving all the time, and significantly cheaper to make. Far less material involved. Third generation, then, are some of the new types of cells that you might read about in the paper. Cells made out of algae and dyes and nanoparticles and so on. We'll talk a little bit about them. There's very few of those on the market, but they're interesting and they present a whole different way of doing photovoltaics, really, and probably will open up different markets. Their efficiencies are relatively low at the moment, but there's no reason to think that they won't improve just as the efficiencies of silicon products have improved. If you look at how a wafer is made into a solar cell, you can see that you have the bulk of the silicon there, but you treat the surfaces so that you have your positive and negative parts of the cell to allow you to get that current to flow, and you also need some way of getting the electricity back out. So you need to put contacts or fingers across the top of your cell, which are those yellow bits. They're metal metal fingers that allow you to collect the electrons that were released by the light so that you can get current to flow. You can see, though, that you would probably like to have a lot of those collectors to try and get most of the electrons out, but the more you put on there, the more you're shading yourself, and therefore the sun isn't going to be able to get through. So you want to try and minimize those from one point of view and maximize them from others, so you're compromising there. You can see that the cell surface has got pyramids and bumps on it, because what you don't want is to have this beautiful shiny mirror-like surface that all the light just bounces straight back off. You want the light to go into the cell and get captured and release electrons. So you're pyramiding or otherwise texturing the surface to try and bounce back anything that reflects and get it back into the cell. One way of reducing the amount of shading that the fingers of the conduction bands make on the surface is to cut a groove with a laser into the top of the cell and bury your contact into that laser groove, so then you're not shading the top of the cell. Other ways of improving efficiency are to invert that pyramid structure on the surface so that more of the reflected light goes in rather than out of the cell. There's a lot of different ways you can play around with cells to improve the efficiency. Second generation cells, as I mentioned, have a very thin layer of material sprayed onto whatever surface you want to use. So you might use glass, or you might use a metal, like a roofing metal, or a whole range of different things are being used now. But you can see with the photo on the end there that because the layer of active material is quite thin, you can have quite see-through panels compared to the standard silicon cell, which is a solid wafer that you can't see through. You can see there in this structure here the layering of different materials to form your cell structure. This is a copper indium gallium diselenide cell, which is one of the more common thin film cell types. And you can see how you layer it here. Now, you're talking about a layering of material which is significantly less than the crystalline products. So the crystalline cells might end up being 200 to 300 microns thick, which is 10 to the minus 6 of a meter, and a thin film product might be only 50. So you can see how much less material you're using and why that has. You can layer with this kind of process. You don't have to stick with just one layer of semiconductor active material. You can put one cell down, and then you can put another cell down over the top of that, and that can increase your efficiency because you're collecting from two different cells. Now, typically, you'd put cells that might collect light on a slightly different wavelength so that you're increasing the bandwidth that you're capturing the light. Or you can even put a layer of cell on top of a crystalline cell, for instance. But you can see some of these multi-junction so-called products and how they're used. Different to the sort of cell and module type that we've been familiar with. The third generation technology then is pushing the physics around big. You're right down to molecular levels. You're down to what's called nanometers at 10 to the minus 9 of a meter now, very tiny particles, which have different sort of characteristics to Newtonian physics. And you can tune these little nanoparticles to capture different wavelengths of light or to release electrons with different wavelengths of light, so that you can build a structure that captures light right across the spectrum by layering different materials together. You can also build nanoscale lattices. These are very tiny, thin layers, even though that looks like a big block there. You know, this is just, these are atoms in here, so very tiny layers. You can make lattices up for which more than one electron is released for each photon of light. So you can see all the different ways that you're increasing the efficiency at each stage. You're widening the spectral band that you're capturing. You're getting more electrons out for each light photon that's in the cell, and so on. And because these types of materials are just in little nano rods of little particles, you can embed them in other materials like plastics or fabrics or paints. And that's the sort of different type of PV product that's now being looked at using this type of material. So you can wear your jacket which has PV in it, and you can charge your mobile phone as you walk around and that kind of thing. Organic cells are also in this third generation category. Rather than using the semiconductor principles that we've talked about, they're using organic principles, principles that are much more similar to photosynthesis and that kind of reaction, or redox cells, for those of you who understand some chemistry. But essentially it's the same principle. You want a material that's going to respond to light by releasing an electron, so that, and then you capture that electron. But a lot of these types of cells are not that solid crystal structure that we think about with silicon cells. They might be more spongy materials that you have to encapsulate between layers of other products. They're not solid. Okay, so again, different ideas about photovoltaics. This is a dye cell. Using a dye as the source of the electron, and this titanium dioxide porous sponge-like layer to capture that electron and use it for the cell. You can see here the sort of bendable, malleable product that you can make out of this sort of cell, which isn't crystalline in the way we normally think of photovoltaics. And this is an array that's used by the Australian Army. You can just roll up these panels of PV and carry it around with you, very lightweight. You can now buy things like this to use with your laptop if you want to go out bush and those sorts of things. There are other ways of increasing the efficiency or increasing the output from your PV array. You can put trackers. You can track either daily from morning till night, or you can track both morning till night as well as seasonally adjusting your array. So single axis or double axis tracking, and you can increase the output from any given panel. Now you have to decide whether you want to do this because, you know, the wonderful characteristics of PV as just being a static thing that just sits there and doesn't move and doesn't do anything. Now you're getting rid of that and you're adding something that moves and has mechanical components that are going to go wrong and those sorts of things. So you need to decide when you want to do this or not, but there are times when it's useful to do it. And you can get up to 30-35% more out of a panel by doing this. You just have to decide whether the cost and all the other issues that arise, for the maintenance issues, are worth it. But some of the people selling tracking systems say, well, it'll only cost you an extra 10% and you'll get 20% more power out of it. So, you know, there are lots of different trackers and they have different cost profiles and output results, so it's one option for you. Another option is to concentrate the light that's hitting your cell so that there's a lot more photons available to release those electrons and create your current. And you can use a range of ways of capturing the light and concentrating it and focusing it onto yourself. You can use a trough like this with the cell in the middle, in the focal point there, or you can have your cell up here in the focal point of this parabolic trough and concentrate the sun onto it, or you can use Fresnel lenses across arrays of PV and have each cell with its own little lens, and so on. Now, again, you're adding to the complexity and the cost of doing this, but maybe the output is worth it. One of the issues I already mentioned is that solar cells prefer to be cool. The cooler they are, the higher the efficiency. So you can imagine if you're having 500 suns worth of light hitting your little cell, that's going to get a little bit hot. And you don't want that to happen, so you've got to try and remove that heat. And therefore you end up having a plumbing sort of add-on to this, to have water or other materials flowing to try and get rid of that heat. Okay, so you can see that you're getting more out of the cell, but you're increasing the other problems that go with it. But nevertheless, you know, they look great. Generating moonlight. So looking at applications then, probably in New Zealand, the most familiar ones are household systems, whether grid or off-grid. You can see that you can have the array in line with the roof, or you can put the array on the optimum angle by putting it on a frame that's on your roof. And that doesn't look so bad, it's just adding slightly to the cost and complexity of the installation. But particularly if you're off-grid, you really want to get the most out of your panels. When you're on-grid, you might not think that is necessary. Commercial buildings are a really useful market because it allows you to deploy a large number of panels and therefore get the cost effectiveness down, get the volume into your market that brings your prices down. You have one in the airport in Auckland, so you can see it if you fly over. You can see that you can integrate the photovoltaics into the building in ways that please architects more than they normally are pleased about using photovoltaics. So that building there, you can see this is the typical architectural glass front on the building, but the top here is actually photovoltaics. They've made it look similar to the rest of the building. You can also have, I think, aesthetically pleasing ways of incorporating photovoltaics into skylights or atria or other things for big commercial buildings or households, but they're typically for these other larger buildings. Then you can have standard large-scale power plants made out of PV cells, PV modules. You can track them, or you can just have a field of them, lots and lots of modules. And they have a different impact on aesthetically, depending on, you know, on how they're done. This array here, the sheep keep grazing around, and you haven't had much impact on the land use, but this one you've obviously had a lot more impact. Now you lose some of the benefits of PV going to this scale, because instead of it being a technology that you're using at the customer end of the load and therefore all the advantages that brings, you're now back to a central power generating paradigm of power systems and so on. But you can get, you know, economies of scale and volume into your market by these sorts of power stations. And at this kind of level, the sort of, you know, 30, 40, 50 megawatt level, it's quite an interesting size for towns and so on. So a useful way of thinking about it. Lots of innovative uses of PV, you know, building products. We saw some of the building integration photos there. This product has airflow behind the module, and in winter you can have that hot air. We can remember that the module's getting hot and you're trying to get rid of that hot air, so you can put that hot air back into your house for heating in winter, or you can vent it in summer to keep the module cool and more efficient. But one of the interesting things that's happening now is using your photovoltaic inverter for active support of the grid. At the moment, if you have a grid-connected system, the rules probably in New Zealand are the same as most places, that you know, you've got to turn your inverter off the minute anything happens to the grid. Whereas actually what you want is to be able to use the characteristics of that inverter to help your grid if there are problems on the grid. And you can use it for voltage support and for grid management. You could, if you wished, have a much more active role to play. Now, as we move towards this idea of smart grids, in other words, grids where, you know, the distinction between the generation and the load and the customer and the electricity company and so on are much more blurred than they are now, with power going in both ways and control of loads and control of generators and so on happening, a mix of things happening, we will see, I think, that you can do a lot more than we're doing at the moment to have the inverters play a useful role. And then if you know, I've heard that New Zealand is looking to be one of the first countries to have widespread rollout of electric vehicles. I don't know if that's still a wish. Well, the last government said that. I don't know if you do that, then, you know, the implications for you are quite significant in terms of the electricity use that entails. But for PV, it's kind of a nice opportunity also to think about what the synergies might be, because rather than saying, okay, we've got this huge new power demand, we'll have to build that coal-fired power station, you could say, well, how about, you know, we have PV charging stations around the place in your workplace, so you drive to work, you plug your vehicle in and you charge it during the day, you go home and you've got an inbuilt storage there that your house could use in that period where otherwise there's a residential peak in your network. So, you know, interesting synergies there to think about for the future. Environmental impact. Well, most of them think PV is fabulous and has very low environmental impact and looks great, but, you know, people who are more sceptical want to know what the real impacts are and, you know, what the hidden agenda is. So, you know, lots of studies have been done into the whole life cycle of photovoltaics to show what its impacts are in terms of material use and energy use and recycling and so on. So if we just look at one of the impacts, and that's the greenhouse impact, the carbon cycle, if you like, of photovoltaics compared to other typical electricity technologies out there, you can see that these are the photovoltaics here. This is the multicrystalline silicon cell here. Now, you have to distinguish between technology when you're doing these LCA studies because, as you can imagine, they're all very different in how they're made and what they're made from. But anyway, that's a multicrystalline cell, and that's a thin film cell over there. So you can see that compared to gas or oil or coal, order of magnitude, just much, much lower greenhouse impact over the life of the product. Wind is even better, and your biomass, it depends on the source and the technology and so on as well. But certainly in terms of replacing fossil fuels, it's a significant benefit to use photovoltaics. Despite that high upfront energy cost in melting the silicon and pulling the crystal out and all of those, despite that, over the life of the cell,